Talk Sheet.
Recorded
live. All right, folks, Pastor Eli James, this is Yahweh's Covenant People, simulcasting on TalkShoe and Eurofolkradio.com. And folks, Eli, why do you guys permit Collins to be... Well, we've explained Collins believes that the Jews are Judah, so you know, we're clarifying that at every possible opportunity. Nevertheless, his history of the Parthians is probably the only thing around. It's probably the only thing around except for some encyclopedias, which I'm going to be quoting from an Encyclopedia Britannica today with regard to Pahlavi, the Germans, and the Aramaeans, who, of course, the Aramaeans and the Germans and the Syrians are all the same people. Here I'm going to copy and paste. These are the coins of the Parthians. And I'm going to post those right here in the chat box. There they are. These are the Arsacid coins. Yeah, his theology is awful because he equates the Jews with Israel. And therefore, he's clueless about the Old Testament. And he's clueless about the Edomites and the Canaanites, which the Jews are actually. So you can look at the faces of the, and it's giving you the names of the Parthian rulers that I've been talking about on the previous two shows. And you can clearly see they're all white. Every single one of them is white. And many of the, most of them are... cameos, side shot cameos, proving their Aryan features. None of them has a hooked nose. They all have really nice button noses like yours truly. Long, straight noses, every single one of them. And they're all related to Israel. They're all Shemites. Shemites. That's the important thing here. They're all Shemites. And so you just look at these coin images, and you can see that these people, these Parthians, were in fact Aryans. And I'm going to, first, here, I'll put this other link in the chat box. This is a very long one. I hope it takes. And this is the article from the Encyclopedia Britannica that I'll be quoting from shortly about Pahlavi and German. Okay, but first I'm going to go to the Bible and quote in Genesis chapter 10, where we find about our kinsmen, the Aramaeans. All right, I'm going to... start with verse 21. To Shem, we're talking about the descendants of Shem. To Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber. Okay, Eber, the Hebrews. The brother of Japheth, the elder, even to him were children born. So, the children of Shem, Elam. Elam, as somebody in the chat room just mentioned, are in fact the Persians. And the Persians were known as the whitest of the whites. And Iran is, you know, where does the word Iran come from? It comes from Aryan. That's where it comes from. Asher, the Assyrians, and Arphaxad, and Lud, the Lydians, who are the eastern Turkey inhabitants, and Aram. Aram, okay, so Aram is a Shemite. The Persians are Shemites. The Assyrians are Shemites. The Arphaxads are Shemites. And the Lydians are all Shemites. Verse 23. And the children of Aram, Uz and Hul and Geter and Mash. So Aram had four descendants, Uz, Hul, Geter, and Mash. So let me see if I can find tribe. Iran is simply a word for Aryan. And the Aryan land today, the land of Iran today encompasses old Persia. The Elamites were, in fact, Shemites. Yes, they were. So, and all of these people spoke Indo-Aryan languages, right? This is what I'm getting at. All of these people spoke Indo-Aryan languages, and they're kinsmen of the Shemites. They're kinsmen of the Hebrews. They're kinsmen of the Israelites. Whereas the universities and the Jews teach, well, no, Germanic and Persian and Aramaic, well, Aramaic obviously is related to Hebrew. Aramaic and Hebrew are directly related to one another. But German is based on the Pahlavi dialect of Aramaic. Yet, the universities and colleges list Germanic as an Indo-Aryan language totally unrelated to the Hebrew. There's something wrong here, folks. There's something really wrong with the academic version of philology. They're all wrong, absolutely wrong. So I'm going to quote here now from the article that I just posted. And they're talking about the Gothic languages. This is very difficult typescript to read. I'll go carefully here. About the year 367, Ulfilas, bishop of the Mosian Goths, translated the New Testament into the Gothic language. The remains of this translation furnish a genuine and at the same time venerable monument to the ancient Gothic dialect. Not more is now extant of that valuable translation than the four Gospels and another fragment containing part of the Epistle to the Romans. Let me just scroll down here. That the alphabet, the Gothic alphabet, consisted of 25 letters. Junius has carefully analyzed those letters and pointed out their powers and sounds in his Gothic alphabet, prefixed to his Glossarium Gothicum. They were long retained in all the European languages derived from the Gothic source, which will be enumerated in the sequel. What kind of language the ancient Gothic was is plain from the fragments above mentioned, but in what respect it agrees with the Oriental tongues or differs from them is not easy to ascertain with precision. As I just quoted to you from the Bible, we know that the Goths are the descendants of the 12 tribes of Israel. So Gothic and Hebrew are directly related, although the Germans are descendants of the Parthians who picked up the Aramaic dialect called Pahlavi, which I'll get to very, very quickly here. We have observed in our section on the Greek that a considerable part of that language must have been derived from the Thracian, which, according to Strabo, there quoted, was the same with Getic or Gothic. So the Getae and the Goths are just two different terms for the same people. Who are the Goths? God's chosen people, the Germanic Israelites. The Thracian tongue will, we are convinced upon comparison, be found analogous to the Chaldean or Syrian. The German, which is a genuine descendant of the Gothic, is full of Persian words. The Old Persian or Pahlavi appears to be a dialect of the Chaldean. Now, who are the Chaldeans? Let me go back to Genesis chapter 10. The Chaldeans. Asher, direct descendant of Shem. Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. Now you're going to tell me that Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Elam spoke Indo-Aryan and the Aramites only spoke Hebrew? No, folks. This is nonsense. It's absolute nonsense what the universities and the Jews teach. The German, which is a genuine descendant of the Gothic, is full of Persian words. The Old Persian or Pahlavi appears to be a dialect of the Chaldean. The learned Junius, near the beginning of his Gothic alphabet, remarks that a very considerable part of the language in question is borrowed from the most ancient Greek. So again, we have a relationship between Greek, Germanic, and Hebrew. Okay, and that Thrace, which is the eastern part of what's known as Turkey today, in Asia Minor, we meet with the city of Perga, which, and I'm just going to give you some Germanic comparisons, because we're talking about the Aramaic language here, the Pahlavi dialect. In Asia Minor, we meet with the city of Perga, which, throwing away the A, is Perg. In every tongue descended from the Gothic, the word Berg, just make it a heavier sound from the P to the B, Berg, such as Hamburg, but which means mountain. And in Gothic, the word Berg means a rock, and metaphorically, or a town or burg, as in Pittsburgh or Hamburg. That's where we get the word burg from. It's from the Pahlavi dialect of Aramaic, because towns were originally built on rocks for the sake of defense. Hence, likewise, Pergamos, the fort or citadel of Troy. Beria in Thracian signified a city. The Chaldaic and Hebrew word bor, hard to me for me to make out the spelling here. It's either B-O-E-R or B-E-E-R, imports a well, and is possibly the original of the Gothic word for beer. There you go. It must be B-E-E-R. Ale. Okay, so there you go. You got Hebrew beer, English beer, Scotch ale. In ancient times, especially in the East, it was customary to build cities in the neighborhood of fountains. Yes, on a rock and near a fountain, if at all possible. The ancients called the Phrygians Beru or Brigus or Brugus. The Gothic word coinciding is obvious. Brug. Dindymus, the name of a city sacred to Sibyl, is compounded of two Gothic words, dun and duum, hard to make it out, both signifying a height or an eminence, and hence a town and enclosure. The word tros seems to be the very Gothic trosh, brave, violent, or which from we get the word true. Okay. And the words fader, mader, dochter, Bruder are so obviously Persian that every etymologist has assigned them to that language. All right, now, but the false dichotomy between the Indo-Aryan and the Hebrew is obvious from chapter 10 of Genesis, giving the lines of descent of these very same people. They are cousins to one another. How in the world can one group of cousins be Indo-Aryans and the other group of cousins be hook-nosed kikes? It's not possible. It's the reason it's not possible is because they're all family. They're all a single family. It's the academics and the Jews who have been lying to us about the derivation of the Hebrews being hook-nosed people, non-Aryan hook-nosed people. These are all, let me just repeat, Eber, to Shem, all the father of Eber, and the children of Shem, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Arab. Okay, and Arphaxad was the grandfather of Eber. So these are all cousins. These people are all cousins. The idea that one group of these cousins are Indo-Aryans and the other group of these cousins are hook-nosed kikes is absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. But this goes to show you, folks, the level of scholarship that obtains when you have Jews dictating history to us. All right, so let's continue. We're going to continue with Mr. Collins' book here on the Parthians. I'm sorry that we don't have any better source material than this, but that's what we have to deal with. Okay, so I have to make some changes here. So Keith Hunt on Parthia. Unfortunately, I can't separate the text from the chat room, so I'm just going to have to go into the text. And this is part three, Parthian Empire Superpower Number 3, which I began to quote from last time. And I'll pick it up right where I believe we left off last time. Toward the end of the 1st century AD, the Parthians established friendly relationships with the Dacians. Who are the Dacians? The Dacae. They are Israelites living along the Danube River, most likely the tribe of Dan, who also disliked the Romans. The establishment of Parthian goodwill with the Dacians, also called the Getae, who I just told you who the Getae are. The Getae are the Goths. There's different words in different languages for the same people. Now, the establishment of Parthian goodwill with the Getae will become significant in chapter 10. In the reign of Mithridates IV, whose image I believe is part of the images I sent you in the chat box, Mithridates IV, 107 to 113 AD, the Parthians began placing Semitic inscriptions on their coins, which you can see for yourself in that link. Previous coins had continued the Seleucid practice of using Hellenistic inscriptions. This was consistent with the fact that the Parthians utilized a Semitic alphabet. And the Parthians were Semites, and so were the Getae. Because all of these people descended directly from Shem, Genesis 10, 21 to 22, and all the way down to 26 and further on. So if people would actually read their Bibles, they would see that all of these dialects are variations of Aramaic. Okay. The Encyclopedia Britannica notes the following regarding Parthia's language. I don't know if he's quoting the same article I'm just quoted from. The alphabets in use in Persia, at least from the time of the Arsacid dynasty onward, are based upon the Aramaic. And Aramaic and Shemitic, folks, are cousin languages. Cousin languages. And since the Germanic and the Greek and even the Roman are related to one another, they're also descendants of Aramaic. The Parthian use of an alphabet based on Aramaic, a Semitic language closely related to Hebrew, obviously because they're cousins, supports the conclusion that the Parthians were the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. If the Parthians and Scythians had originated deep in the interior of Asia, their alphabet and language would not have been Semitic. The fact that the Parthians utilized an alphabet which originated in the eastern Mediterranean region inhabited by the Israelites and Aramaeans confirms that Parthian origins were in the eastern Mediterranean, the former homeland of the 10 tribes of Israel. Now, there is another here. Let me go to Genesis 10. I'm going to read quickly the pulpit commentary on Genesis 10:23, which will give us a geographical understanding of these children. The children of Aram, Uz, from whom was named the land of Uz in Job 1:1, southeast of Palestine, a tract of the Arabian desert, and Hul, H-U-L, in Armenia, Josephus, that part called Kolibetain, or House of Hul, the Hilate of Syria, near the Emesines, Koela Syria, Hule, near the sources of the Jordan, and Geter, okay, of uncertain situation, and Mash, traced in the Musmasius of Armenia. So what we have is these descendants of Aram can be traced from Damascus just to the northeast of Palestine, where the 12 tribes of Israel dwelt. And you go straight north from there and a bit northeast, hugging the Euphrates River as you go north, straight to the Black Sea, to Armenia. Armenia, obviously, named after Aram. So this whole territory north of Palestine, hugging the Euphrates River all the way to the Black Sea, is properly called Armenia after Aram. Okay, so that's the geography, and it just shows that these related people, Damascus is just a stone's throw from the 10 northern tribes. In fact, I think the some of the 10 northern tribes actually dwelt in Damascus. So showing the relationship. So those people all spoke Aramaic, Hebrew being a dialect of the Aramaic, and that's why these people were able to understand one another. Okay, so let's continue here. It's really important to understand the connection of the languages, the philology here, to show that we are indeed talking about one and the same people. One and the same people. So, okay, let's continue. The year after the death of Mithridates, the Roman Emperor Trajan, and I've been pronouncing it wrong, I've been pronouncing it Trajan, it's Trajan, broke the peace and began military hostilities. Trajan, by subterfuge, had a nephew of the Parthian monarch killed, who had come to him in anticipation of a peaceful settlement. In noting Trajari's deceitfulness, Rawlinson describes Trajari's actions as disgraceful and base. Well, he was in fact a Roman. Filled with vanity and pride, Trajan set out to emulate the Asian conquests of Alexander the Great. While wintering at Antioch of Syria, and Syria, of course, is the same as Aramaic, Trajan barely escaped with his life when he was almost killed in a destructive earthquake, which was of violence and duration unexampled in ancient times. Many Romans of the highest rank perished. Besides leveling Antioch, it destroyed 9 other cities and Roman provinces in Asia Minor and Greece. Was it a portent of things to come? Rawlinson commented, "It seemed as if Providence had determined that the new glories which Rome was gaining by the triumphs of her arms should be obscured by calamities of a kind that no human power could avert or control, that the reign of Trajan should go down to posterity as one of gloom, suffering, and disaster." Well, that was true of just about all the emperors from Christ forward. If the earthquakes, except unto Constantine, who was the one who set the Christians free, so to speak, but we covered that in our series on the pagan origins of Christmas. Constantine was actually the emperor who converged paganism and Christianity, thus laying the groundwork for the destruction of Christianity. If the earthquakes were a divine warning, Trajan paid them no heed. He resumed his invasion of Parthia and was almost unopposed as he marched through Mesopotamia, advancing as far as the Persian Gulf. Trajan then indulged in egomania, regarding himself as another Alexander, taking a pleasure voyage down the Tigris River into the Persian Gulf, and regretting that his advanced years prevented him from making India the term of his labors, just like Alexander. The Bible states in Proverbs 16:18 that pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Trajan was about to become a living example of the truth of that proverb. The Parthians had not yet fought a serious pitched battle. Either they were caught unprepared by Trajan's campaign, or they sensed that the usual Roman arrogance would soon cause the conquered Parthian provinces to realize what a good thing they had under Parthian rule. While Trajan was indulging his ego on the Persian Gulf, the recently conquered Parthian provinces rebelled on a massive scale. Although the Romans burned Seleucia and other major cities, the natives exacted a heavy toll on the Romans and even exterminated an entire Roman army. The Parthians, meanwhile, risked little as their former subjects did the fighting to remove the hated Romans. History was repeating itself. These same native populations had previously fought the Seleucid Greeks in order to return to Parthian rule. Trajan was in a dangerous position as his line of retreat was full of hostile nations. Additionally, it was as if nature itself became a Parthian ally. It is recorded that the Romans suffered from the heat, from the swarms of flies, which disputed with them every morsel of their food and every drop of their drink, beer included. and finally from violent hail and thunderstorms. Perhaps it was no coincidence the Parthians were Israelites, some of whom worshipped the God of Israel. At least one Parthian provincial king openly worshipped Israel's God in the apostolic era, and the Parthians were placing Semitic inscriptions on their coins. Now, here Collins is making some trying to make some dramatic difference between Semitic and Aramaic. There is no dramatic difference between Semitic and Aramaic. They're virtually identical. They're dialects of one another, with the Aramaic very obviously being older. The last fact indicates that the Parthians were officially identifying with their Semitic Israelite roots. It is also quite significant that a delegation of Parthia's nobility, the wise men or magi of Matthew, had come to worship Jesus Christ, as this indicates God was closely involved with portions of the leadership of Parthia's empire. And of course, these Parthians would have been familiar with Daniel chapter 9, where the 70 weeks were prophesied, so they were very much clued in to Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy and the coming of the Messiah. Given the above, it is possible that God himself caused the earthquakes, plagues, the flies, etc., just like in the Old Testament. Okay. Most unusual at this time was the lack of any major Parthian military action against the Romans. In the past, they quickly clashed with the invading Romans, generally routing them on the battlefield. Again, how is it possible that the academic world is utterly ignorant of Parthia? Utterly ignorant of Parthia, when the history of Parthia and the Romans is so extensive. I'm going to put this link here. This is the article that I'm quoting from here, Keith Hunt. And I'll see if I can minimize both here. Here we go. Finally got it right. So I've got both the chat room and the article in front of me. Split screen. Isn't white technology wonderful? Okay. So why did they not confront Trajan? Were they internally weakened, or had the Parthians been told by an unnamed prophet of God not to fight because the battle was Yahweh's? The Parthians reoccupied their territory as it was abandoned by the retreating Romans. Yeah, well, why fight the retreating army that's going to, probably be wiped out by the elements as they retreat? Trajan soon died after his humiliating retreat. And the new Roman Emperor Hadrian unilaterally gave back to Parthia all territory taken by Trajan, yielded Armenia back to Arsacid rule, and pulled all Roman forces back on their side of the Euphrates River. Now, Armenia is the territory just south of the Black Sea. So if you take that territory, which is just to the west of the Euphrates River and north of the conjunction of the Tigris and Euphrates, and you follow, if you go straight down, you run into Damascus, and you run into the territory of Elam or Syria. Okay, so you can see the relationship between all of these people: Aram, Elam, Asher, of course, Asher being the Assyrians, Nineveh, that's also in Armenia and to the east of Armenia. But the Mesopotamia, our ancestors came from Mesopotamia, and every last one of them was white. Every last one of them. This is the reality, folks. And anybody who tries to suggest that the Israelites were hook-nosed kikes, unrelated to the Elamites, the Arphaxadites, the Hebrews, etc., etc., is a liar. They simply haven't read their Bibles, which includes the Jews. So we are covering the reality, folks, the reality that very, very few people in historical renditions even attempt to cover. Rome avoided any Parthian wars for another half century. Indeed, when the hostilities did seem imminent at one time, peace ensued from another summit conference in 122 AD between the Roman and Parthian emperors Hadrian and Chosroes. The next Parthian emperor, Vologases, continued the use of Semitic inscriptions. Volgasa Malka, that's probably where you get the name for the Volga River, Volgasa Malka, on his coins. The use of the word Malka for king is significant. John 18:10 shows us that Malchus was being used as a Hebrew proper name in the first century AD. So why would these Indo-Aryans use Hebrew words to describe themselves? And the Parthians used the consonants M-L-C-H to designate the Semitic word king on their coins. Well, Melchizedek. Melchizedek. When one considers that the C-H symbol can represent the same phonetic sound as a K, the origin of the Semitic word is clear. So the ch sound becomes a K. The Parthian switch to Semitic inscriptions on their coins is evidence of renewed awareness of their Semitic Aramaic origin, which Collins doesn't seem to be familiar with the fact that Semitic and Aramaic are identical. This watershed event has not been fully appreciated in the histories of the Parthians, and it deserves further comment. Acts 2:9 records that many people from Parthia and their provinces, the Medes, Elamites, Mesopotamians, served the God of Israel in the first century AD. Hello? These Indo-Aryans. These Indo-Aryans speaking a Germanic Pahlavi language, which Collins and the Jews falsely differentiate from Hebrew, shows that they're in fact total relatives of the Hebrews, speaking very similar languages. The visit of the Parthian wise men or magi to worship and offer gifts to the child Jesus Christ is a striking event. The fact that high-ranking Parthian magi came to worship Jesus Christ documents that God was very personally involved with some of the Parthian nobility and had even revealed Jesus Christ's divinity to them. The timing of their arrival in Jerusalem further indicates that the Parthian magi were familiar with the Hebrew prophecies, indicating that Messiah was due at that time. Thank you very much, Mr. Collins. Excellent point. Parthia was evangelized by Christians. Eusebius recorded that the Apostle Thomas was sent to Parthia. 1 Peter 5:13 records that the Apostle Peter was in Parthian territory, the city of Babylon, when he wrote his first epistle. Since Matthew 10:6 states that Jesus sent his apostles to the lost sheep, that is, the exiled sheep of the house of Israel, the presence of at least two apostles in Parthian territory confirms that they were evangelizing the 10 tribes of Israel located in Parthia, and also their cousins, the Aramaeans and the Elamites and the Persians. Remember, the gospel was to be taken to all white nations. Their message, because the restoration of all things Adamic will be, become reality at the wedding feast of the Lamb. The dominion verses of Genesis chapter 1, verses 28 through 30, apply only to the Adamites, and all of the Adamites will be restored to their proper place of dominion. Their message surely included the theme, you Parthians are the 10 tribes of Israel, and the Messiah has sent us to you. Since some of Parthia's ruling class, the Magi, had already worshipped Jesus Christ, the apostles were assured of a much warmer reception for their message in Parthia than in Roman domains. Absolutely well said. The above reveals that Parthian Roman events of this period must be understood in the context of what was clearly a significant penetration of the Christian religion into Parthia. The Encyclopedia Britannica comments as follows regarding this period of Parthia's history. Greek culture practically vanishes and gives place to Aramaic. Aramaic. Aramaic is Hebrew, folks. It is significant that in the future the kings of Messene stamped their coinage with Aramaic legends. This Aramaic victory was powerfully aided by the ever-increasing progress of Christianity. Edessa, a city in which the last king of Asruin, Abgar IX, had been converted to the faith. Again, just look at those coins that I referenced earlier, and you will see that all of these Parthian kings, as all Hebrews, were in fact Aryans. According to Harper's Bible Dictionary, Aramaic was, quote, a Semitic language closely related to Hebrew, and several passages in the OT are written in a, but nevertheless, it's spoken by Germans who are supposedly Indo-Aryans, unrelated to the Hebrews. What nonsense we get from the Jews. And written in official Aramaic, cited our texts in Ezra, Daniel, Jeremiah, and Genesis. Jesus probably spoke a dialect of Western Aramaic, and some words in the NT come from Aramaic. Talita Kumi, Maranatha, and Golgotha, and also the words Eli Eli Lama Sabachthani, the words spoken by Jesus as he hung on the cross, Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? The prominence of Aramaic in Parthian life during the Christian apostolic and post-apostolic period was linked to the spread of Christianity into Parthia from the Mideast, where Aramaic was dominant. Add to this the record of Josephus, the Judahite, not Jewish, the Judahite historian of that period, who stated that the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel are exceedingly numerous and living beyond Euphrates. There it is, all over Mesopotamia. As mentioned earlier, the phrase beyond Euphrates was for Josephus a euphemism which meant in Parthia's empire, since the Euphrates had long been recognized the border between the Roman and Parthian empires. If educated Judahites, such as Josephus, realized that the Parthians were the 10 tribes of Israel, and since regular commerce and communication occurred between Judea and Parthia, as Acts 2:9 confirms, then it is logical that the Parthians also realized their origins at that time. Well, James 1:1, to the 12 tribes of Israel scattered abroad. The Israelites knew that their relatives among the Greeks and Romans were Israelites. They knew it. But today's Judeo-Christians don't know it. That's because they pay absolutely no attention to history. The reign of Vologasus II, Parthia's emperor for 19 years, is characterized as 130 to 149 AD, is characterized as having a general character of tranquility. This tranquility within Parthia's ruling house stands in stark contrast to the murderous internal struggles of the Arsacids prior to the Christian apostolic era. As Christianity penetrated the Parthian Empire, it would seem that its benign doctrines influenced the conduct of Parthia's rulers as well. Predictably, the Romans eventually reneged on their treaty with Parthia. During Trajan's invasion, the Romans had captured a Parthian golden throne and had promised to return it as part of the peace settlement. After attempts to secure Roman compliance with the treaty failed, Parthia went to war. Under Vologasus III, Parthia conquered Armenia and restored a native ruler as king of Armenia. A native ruler who was also a relative. A Roman legion crossed the Euphrates and was destroyed by the Parthians. The Parthians then crossed the Euphrates into Roman Syria and Palestine, but their presence was short-lived. A Roman army led by Avidius Cassius won a major battle against the Parthians, who retreated across the Euphrates. Avidius Cassius then led his army across the Euphrates and proceeded to reconquer Parthian territories occupied briefly during Trajan's invasion. Cassius burned Seleucia, having then 400,000 residents. Wow, that's a big town. And captured Ctesiphon, Parthia's western capital. The Romans marched at will through Parthia's western provinces, and the Parthians seemed powerless to resist. Just when the Romans seemed invincible, however, they were driven from Parthia, not by a Parthian army, but by a terrible plague. One wonders if the arrogant Romans taunted the heavens with words like, "Where is the god of the Parthians who supposedly plagued Trajan? Parthia's god can't protect them from us." Whether such an attitude provoked a divine response as it did in the time of King Hezekiah of ancient Judah, or whether God merely allowed the Parthians to come to the point of realizing their dependence on him, this plague devastated the entire Roman Empire. This plague was so overwhelming that there was no doubt in Roman minds that the plague was supernatural in nature. The polytheistic Romans, with no awareness of the Creator, Yahweh, attributed the divine plague to spells of the Chaldeans, again, Chaldeans being Assyrians, also descendants of Shem, unleashed because of Roman excesses in looting the Temple of Apollo. The plague of a strange and terrible character was so virulent that Rawlinson refers to the return of this army to Rome as a march of death through the provinces. Well, they probably brought the plague back to Rome. As it spread the disease throughout the provinces of the Roman Empire, Rawlinson cites Roman historians as citing, they got what they deserved. They brought the plague back to Rome. The pestilence raged with special force throughout Italy and spread as far as the Rhine and Atlantic Ocean. More than one half of the entire population and almost the whole Roman army was carried off by it. So this is as bad as the Black Death, which was in the Middle Ages. Okay, so let me scroll down here. A decade later, another major Roman-Parthian war was fought in approximately 194 to 200 AD, in which subject Mesopotamian peoples massacred Roman garrisons, aided by Parthian vassal kings. This led to a Roman-Parthian war when Severus, Rome's emperor, led an army across the Euphrates. Diverted by internal problems, Severus returned to Rome. The Parthians attacked, routed the Roman armies, besieged Nisibis, a Roman headquarters, and crossed the Euphrates into Roman territory. Severus returned to the Middle East. Okay, so here, this is some of the history of the Parthian-Roman wars, which take up a great portion of the history of Rome, yet your modern history books are utterly vacuous. Absolutely vacuous. There's a vacuum of the history of Parthia in general Roman histories. They say nothing about Parthia whatsoever. And this is the reason why. It's because the evidence clearly shows that Parthia was an Israelite Aramaic kingdom. Israelite Scythian Cimmerian kingdom. And the Jews don't want you to know this. Plus, if you knew the connection between the Aramaeans and the Hebrews, you would not be able to make this silly distinction between the Indo-Aryan, with Germanic being an example, versus Hebrew. They're identical, folks. They're identical. So because these academics believe Jewish lies, they know nothing about the history of language. And it says here, to be continued. I'm going to go to the next page. Okay. The Great Forgotten Parthian Israel Empire, number 6. From the book, The Lost 10 Tribes Found, by Stephen Collins. Okay, and it continues. However, all the Parthians throughout the empire were outraged by the violations of the tombs and corpses of their dead emperors. Again, the Romans, you know, grave robbers. Indeed, Rome's armies had never even come close to Parthia's homeland, which was located southeast of the Caspian Sea, all right, in Mesopotamia. Ctesiphon, the western capital known to the Romans, was nowhere near the actual homeland of the Parthians, who were their headquarters was further east. It is possible that Ctesiphon was an administrative center for governing their western provinces, but that other capitals existed eastward in their empire. The Scythian nature of the Parthians is well known. Scythian reverence for the dead was an historic trait, as it is still among our people, the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, and Caucasian Israelites. When Darius attacked the Scythians many centuries earlier near the Black Sea, he was warned that retribution would be most dire if he desecrated Scythian cemeteries. Given the historic relationship between Parthia and the Sakae tribes of Scythia, it is possible that Scythian tribes furnished troops for this battle as well. The Roman headquarters in the area was at Nisibis, near the modern border of Syria and Turkey. The Parthian emperor, Artabanus IV, spurned an offer of peace, as his army was there to exact vengeance and spill as much Roman blood as possible. Again, the Parthian Empire never existed, folks. Not according to existing Western histories, academic Jewish histories. The Parthian and Roman armies, both headed by their emperors, clashed in what must have been one of the fiercest and bloodiest battles ever fought in the ancient world. What occurred was not merely a battle, but the death struggle of two mighty empires. Cited in classical writers, Rawlinson states, "The Battle of Nisibis was the fiercest and best contested which was ever fought between the rival powers. It lasted 3 days. The army of Artabanus was numerous and well-appointed. Like almost every Parthian force, it was strong in cavalry and archers, and it had a novel addition of soldiers clad in complete armor and carrying long spears or lances who were mounted on camels." Remember last time I told you that the Parthian Empire is the protogenic, protogenic, for lack of a better word, of the Teutonic Knights. The Germanic Knights, the Teutonic Knights come from Parthia. Here we get evidence right here from Rawlinson. Completely clad in armor, carrying spears or lances, who were mounted on camels. The Romans suffered greatly from the bows of the horse archers and from the lances of the corps mounted on camels, and as they retired, they strewed the ground with spiked balls and other contrivances for the injuring the feet of the animals. This kind of fighting went on for 3 full days. The armor-clad Parthians must have looked like medieval knights as they charged the Romans with leveled lances. The Romans, however, were ingenious in countering these assaults by maiming the Parthian animals. The killing was awesome. It is recorded that the bodies of the dead were piled to such a height that maneuvers of the troops were impeded by them, and at last the two contending hosts could scarcely see one another. Wow. At this point, I think it sounds like the Judgment Day, folks. We're getting ready to see this kind of fighting again. At this point, I think the fighting has already started in Europe, with those the Muslim hordes, that flood of, that invasion of immigrants, Revelation 12, 17, the flood of immigrants into Europe, financed and organized by Jews. We're going to see another, you're going to see the bodies piled high, folks. You're going to see the bodies piled high. By the way, David James and I are going to do a thorough analysis of Revelation 12 tomorrow on 1-to-1, which is going to be at 2 p.m. Central Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. So be sure to catch that one, because we're living to a Revelation 12, 17 as we speak. At this point of mutual exhaustion, the battle ended with a clear Parthian victory. Macrinus, the Roman emperor, fled the scene and afterward agreed to repatriate all Parthian captives and to pay a huge war indemnity to Parthia. In his book Persia, published in 1888, historian S.G.W. Benjamin writes of this event. Macrinus, the Roman emperor, was obliged to pay an indemnity of 50 million denarii to the great rival of Rome, almost in the very hour when the doom of Parthia was sounding on the great bell of time. The hero, Artabanus, Parthia's emperor, who wrested a war indemnity from a Roman emperor, was also the last of his line. Now here, this is the point I wanted to get to. What happened? What happened to Parthia? And, well, obviously, they moved north. So my curiosity here is, why did they have to move north? The classical Greco-Roman historians wrote copiously about Scythian and Parthian history. As recently as 1888, a historian could still recognize the Battle of Nisibis between Rome and Parthia as one of the greatest events of world history. Yet today, the important histories of Scythia and Parthia have been virtually erased from history texts. What caused this glaring omission? Well, Mr. Collins, it's easy. The Jews. It's the Jews who erased all this history. During the 19th century, the famous historian George Rawlinson wrote books about the Parthian Empire in an attempt to counter what he called a defective and false view of history, which omitted the major role of the Parthian Empire in world history. Is it only coincidental that modern history books de-emphasize or omit the histories of empires founded by the 10 tribes of Israel, such as Phoenicia, Carthage, Scythia, and Parthia, while waxing eloquent about the histories of the non-Israelite empires? Well, it's because the Jews don't want you to know that these nations are, in fact, Israelite in origin. They want you to believe that the Jews are the only surviving tribe of the 12 tribes when they're not even one of them. In the late 19th and 20th centuries, the dogma of evolution becomes the new religion of secularized world. It is now politically incorrect to have a real faith in the Bible or the God of Israel. And of course, this is the Jews doing as well. Remember the protocol say, we will unleash the nihilists, the atheists. It's the Jews doing. It hardly seems coincidental, and of course, Mr. Collins does not recognize any of this. It hardly seems coincidental that the world's awareness of the history of the 10 tribes of Israel declined even as evolution became the new god of modern secularized literature. And of course, the Jews are totally responsible for all of this rewriting of history and erasing of history. Okay, we have about 10 minutes left. I'm going to... Based on biblical precedent, it is a symptom of advanced moral decay in a society when its leaders seek to the occult or astrology. Okay, so here, let's see what's going on here. The Parthian Empire had won a great victory over the Roman Empire. One would expect the Parthian Empire to be reinvigorated by its triumph, but in fact, the end of its empire was at hand. It is recorded that in this time of trial, Artabanus IV, Parthia's emperor, sought to the occult for guidance and was told Parthia's empire was about to end. This account echoes that of Saul, the first Israelite king whose effort to seek occult guidance via an ancient seance led to his defeat and death. 1 Samuel 28:7-25. Based on biblical precedent, it is a symptom of advanced moral decay in a society when its leaders seek to the occult, astrology and channelers, and also probably to Jews, for guidance. Such actions not only forfeit God's favor via the sin of idolatry, but also invite his punishment. If God had divinely protected Parthia in earlier battles, this sin of Artabanus was especially grievous. Soon after one of Parthia's greatest victories over Rome, Parthia collapsed. I would say also that because the 10 tribes of Israel were banished by Yahweh to the north for their idolatry to begin with, chances are this idolatry remained. And much of their, even though they were Israelites, their obedience to Yahweh's law was probably scant. In 220 AD, the province of Persia revolted. A series of three battles was fought, which resulted in a Persian victory in 227 AD, costing Artabanus IV his life and effectively ending the Parthian Empire. The Sasanian Persian Empire replaced the Parthian Empire, and the Parthians were forced to migrate out of their old empire to flee the Persians. Some histories discuss Parthian history as part of Persian history, although this is misleading. Although the Parthians ruled the territory of the previous Persian Empire, the Parthians and Persians were two separate people in the same region of the world. Yeah, the Persians were from Elam. Okay, from Elam. And the Parthians were from, but also Shemites, and they were also Aramites. And, of course, the Parthians descended from Eber and also from Shem. So they were still cousins, and they probably knew they were cousins, and they spoke similar languages. The Parthians had been the subjects of the Persians before establishing their own empire, in which the Persians were then a subject nation. In 220 to 227 AD, the Persians threw off the Parthian rule and drove the Parthians out of the region. Where they went and the new names by which they came to be known will be discussed in chapter 10. Yes, Rahab, you're talking about the Old Testament. Rahab was certainly, she may have been a Hamite, but she was possibly an Israelite. It's hard to say because we're not given her genealogy, but she was definitely a friend of the Israelites. She's the one who protected the Israelite spies from the Canaanites. Okay, so it looks like the information I'm looking for is contained in chapter 10. Don't have time to do that. We've only got 5 minutes left for today's show. So I'll just read on in this section here. There's no doubt in my mind, absolutely no doubt in my mind that these Parthians migrated north and became the Teutonic Germans. Teut being the word for Deutsch. Teut, Deutsch, simply meaning people, or, you know, related people. Besides Parthia, portions of the 10 tribes of Israel also ruled a Saka kingdom to the east of Parthia in the region of modern Pakistan and West India. Various Saka kings began ruling in Pakistan and northwest India in the 1st century BC. These rulers were later replaced by Pallava or Indo-Parthian. Here's your Pahlavi dialect. It's a dialect of Aramaic, a dialect of Persian. Where's Persia? Just to the north and east of Palestine, folks. Just to the north and east of Palestine. So you see, the Indo-Aryans can't be related to the Hebrews because their countries bordered each other, right? Therefore, they can't be related to each other. This is Jewish logic, folks. Among these rulers was Gondopheres, who exhibited the name of the Davidic royal line and the kingdom of Judah, namely Pheres. The Encyclopedia Britannica states, the name Pahlavi means Parthian. These Saka kings bore the name of Isaac, and their kings had Parthian names. No, not possible. They're Indo-Aryans. All the philology textbooks tell us they're Indo-Aryans. They can't be Hebrews. We do not know to what extent the Parthian emperors and the Saka kings either cooperated or competed. Richard Fry writes the following concerning Parthian-Saka affairs. Indian sources imply that the Sakas and the Falawas, Parthians, were allies in their Indian conquests, and this would seem to be corroborated by the coins with both Saka and Parthian names. However, the adoption of the title King of Kings by Gondopheres would imply that these Indo-Parthian kings were completely independent of the Parthian rulers. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. That's Gondopheres. You know, why would that make them independent? He's using a Hebrew and actually by this time a Christian terminology. The title King of Kings was a standard title of Parthian emperors, and the Indo-Parthian use of the term confirms their affinity with Parthia, even if they constituted a separate kingdom. But it was a separate white kingdom, a separate Hebrew kingdom, a separate Shemitic kingdom. While little is known of Parthia's eastern affairs, we do know that Parthian dominance and or influence extended into modern India. Yes, they're known as the Indo-Aryans. Okay, a couple more minutes left. Josephus states, I have proposed for the sake of such as live under the government of the Romans to translate these books into the Greek tongue, which I formerly composed in the language of our own country, which is, of course, Hebrew, or he could have meant Aramaic, and sent to the upper barbarians, identified in a footnote as the Parthians, Babylonians, Arabians, and the Judahites beyond Euphrates and the Adiabene. Josephus, before writing in Greek to the Romans, had written Wars of the Judeans in his own Semitic language so the Parthians and other nations in the Parthian Empire could read his works. Note the phrase beyond Euphrates is again used as a euphemism to designate Parthian territory. When he wrote to the Romans, he was mindful of Roman sensitivities in calling the Parthians upper barbarians. Rawlinson states, last statement here, rats, somebody's trying to call. Get rid of them. Josephus regarded the Parthians as familiar with Hebrew or Syro-Chaldaic, as I told you. Chaldean and Syrian and Hebrew are essentially the same language, and wrote his history of the Judean Wars in his own native tongue before he put out his Greek version, for the benefit especially of the Parthians, among whom he declares he had many readers and relatives, no doubt. Folks, now you're getting the straight dope. Hear from yours truly, Pastor Eli James, on Yahweh's Covenant People, without Jewish editorializing telling you that the Hebrews and the Aramaeans and the Chaldeans are an unrelated people when I just showed you from Genesis chapter 10, verses 21 through 26, that they are cousins, all speaking related languages. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh, pass the ammunition for Yahweh's truth. And I'll see you all tomorrow on Restoration Hour and One-to-One. Thanks for listening. Take care. Good night. And praise Yahweh.